Are we ready for the storms of the 21st century?
Almost everyone assumed, including hospital administrators, that the generators would continue working. And so no matter what happened, there would still be power. There would be emergency backup power. And what we saw was that the surge levels were so high, so fast, that in many of these places, the generators literally drowned. And so what we saw were these darkened floors, darkened stairwells, and while staff had drilled and worked on what they would do in an emergency scenario, it was never really with the idea that it would be in pitch black stairwells, moving patients down 20 flights of stairs, hand over fist with flashlights and things like that. So incredibly dramatic. And I think it really called attention to the fact that a lot of our plans are not sufficient for the disasters of the 21st century.
That's Catherine Miles. We talk with her about her gripping moment-by-moment account of Hurricane Sandy. The book is Superstorm. Then, beachfront homeowners are trying to save their property from sea level rise and storm surge by building hard structures to keep the ocean at bay. But at what cost to the public? And does it even work?
The ocean doesn't withhold any fury. These are just man-made structures, and when you get storm surges, and on top of those heavy waves, you have tons of water pouring on these structures, and very few of them can withstand it.
That's marine scientist Doug Hardy. He tells us about a report he just submitted to Southold on Long Island on behalf of the town's Conservation Advisory Council. It's called The Starvation of Southold's Beaches. It's got lessons for every coastal resident and every U.S. taxpayer. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. As this show is being produced, Boston is readying itself for another big snowstorm. Over the past 17 days, the city has seen 77 inches of the white stuff fall. Winter Storm Juno at the end of January didn't just bring mountains of snow to eastern Massachusetts. It also pummeled coastal communities with destructive storm surges. Scientists say that climate change most likely has an important part to play in the giant storms that are battering the Northeast ever more frequently. The mother of all such storms is still fresh in the memory of countless residents of New York and New Jersey, Superstorm Sandy. It was the largest Atlantic storm system ever recorded, the second costliest storm in U.S. history, and 117 Americans lost their lives. My guest, Catherine Miles, has written the first complete account of what happened during the 9 days of Sandy's life, from when it first formed way out in the ocean until it slammed into the eastern seaboard in the waning days of October 2012. She tells how Sandy was like no other storm before it, a hybrid of a hurricane and nor'easter. It overwhelmed the weather scientists who were tracking it. Government leaders like New York City's Take Charge Mayor Bloomberg were left haplessly scrambling to cope. Catherine Miles shows the toll that years of underfunding has taken on the infrastructure the U.S. uses to forecast deadly storms, leaving us vulnerable to the storms of the 21st century. But she also tells the stories of Sandy's heroes, those who risked life and limb to rescue others caught in the storm's gigantic waves. Catherine Miles teaches writing in Chatham University's MFA program and is the author of two previous books. Well, Catherine Miles, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
I went through Hurricane Sandy, not in New York City, but out on Long Island. But I had a close friend who was scheduled for surgery, brain surgery, at NYU Langone Medical Center at the end of October 2012. And as he was awaiting his surgery, Superstorm Sandy hit, and he got evacuated. On page 3 of your book, you describe that evacuation. Tell us what it was that you discovered about the evacuation of NYU and some of the other area hospitals.
Well, this really became an issue both, I think, of policy and infrastructure. And what we saw in Mayor Bloomberg's very late decision to evacuate was a lot of people found themselves kind of ill-prepared, really, to deal with that evacuation order. And that evacuation order did not address folks who were in either assisted living centers or in hospitals. And so those people, by and large, hunkered down. And what we saw with policy and emergency management evacuation policies is that almost everyone assumed, including hospital administrators, that the generators would continue working. And so no matter what happened, there would still be power. There would be emergency backup power. And what we saw was that the surge levels were so high, so fast, that in many of these places, the generators literally drowned. And so what we saw were these darkened floors, darkened stairwells, and while staff had drilled and worked on what they would do in an emergency scenario, it was never really with the idea that it would be in pitch black stairwells, moving patients down 20 flights of stairs, hand over fist with flashlights and things like that. So incredibly dramatic. And I think it really called attention to the fact that a lot of our plans are not sufficient for the disasters of the 21st century.
Yeah, and I want to go back to the issue of Bloomberg and the evacuation. But before we do that, I'd like to ask you more about the storm surge, because as I remember and as you report in your book, Superstorm, you know, Hurricane Sandy was not really a hurricane when it hit New York. It may have been a superstorm. It's really not too clear what exactly it was, but its winds were not at hurricane strength. It was the storm surge that was a problem. Explain that.
Sure, and I think this is a surprise to most Americans, but historically speaking, hurricanes do a lot more damage, particularly in terms of human life, because of storm surge than they do of wind. And if we look at the overall fatalities, we see the overwhelming majority of people who die, they actually drowned rather than being in a house that collapses because of the wind. And what we're learning is that the surge models that we have and the understanding that we have for surge is very site-specific. It's very contingent upon things like tide levels, geography, these sorts of factors. And so a surge, for instance, in the Gulf of Mexico may kind of creep its way up because the tides are not that pronounced, because the terrain on the ocean floor is really quite level. If you apply that same storm to a place like New York or Maine, much higher tides, topography that really funnels water in, what we see is not this gradual creeping of water that most people assume, but instead something that really looks like almost a tidal wave. And that was the experience of so many people, especially on Staten Island and Long Island, that they literally went from being bone dry and thinking everything was fine one minute to these huge waves of water coming in, washing away cars, washing away entire homes. And in fact, the most of the fatalities from the storm were water-related fatalities.
Yes, in fact, we had a case right out here in Montauk. There was a woman who must have felt good enough to be walking her dog out on the road when the storm surge came and took her and the dog away.
And, you know, this is really just sort of an issue of how we deal with risk, both as individuals and as a culture. And what we saw over and over again was people really downplaying the risk that this storm posed. And over 70% of the people ordered to evacuate during the storm disobeyed those evacuation orders. And that's almost an exact inverse of what happened in New Orleans during Katrina, where 70% of the people heeded those evacuation warnings. So it really comes down to our personal responsibility, as well as our sort of national ability to communicate risk to people in a way that they're able to internalize it. Social scientists tell us that it takes about 3 days for people to really get that the evacuation order matters, that it's happening to them, that they need to take it seriously. And in the case of Sandy, New Yorkers didn't get that amount of time. They got fewer than 6 hours before public transportation was shut down. So for a lot of people, by the time they decided to leave, they had no way to get out.
And in that case, of course, it wasn't individual responsibility. It was the responsibility of the city of New York, of Bloomberg in particular. Why did Bloomberg downplay the storm until it was too late? That's a very important chapter, I think, of your book, or point of your book, is how that actually happened and why.
I really wanted to try to unpack that for New Yorkers and for the nation, really. And I spent a lot of time talking to people both in the New York City Office of Emergency Management and also senior staff in Bloomberg's administration. And what they told me was that they had assumed that they would be receiving information, surge reports, forecast reports from the National Hurricane Center. But when this storm began to transition into a hybrid, the protocols for the National Hurricane Center were so narrowly defined that they were literally unable to continue issuing watches, warnings, and advisories for the storm. So they made an 11th-hour decision to hand off responsibility for the forecasting to regional National Weather Service offices. And these are offices that are staffed by tremendous meteorologists, very talented, very dedicated people, but they don't have anywhere near the resources that the National Hurricane Center has. And they also don't have nearly the mouthpiece to get that information to a national audience like the National Hurricane Center. So what the folks in New York told me was, look, you know, we assumed we were going to be getting this information from the National Hurricane Center. When that didn't happen, we were getting data that didn't really look familiar to us from the National Weather Service. We were confused. We didn't have what we needed to make a confident decision. The National Weather Service really gets its hackles up when that sort of thing is said, because they say, look, we gave you more than enough information that you needed to make a very decisive decision early. And if we look at, for instance, Governor Christie's response in New Jersey, or if we look at places like Connecticut, Philadelphia, Delaware, who also had evacuation warnings much, much earlier, and using the same sort of information we gave you, we really don't buy that. So we see a lot of back and forth here, a lot of debate. And it's understandable, because obviously this decision put a lot of New Yorkers at risk.
Well, one reason that happened was because an evacuation had been ordered just a year before with Hurricane Irene. And while Hurricane Irene devastated Vermont and other parts north, it gave a pretty light smack to New York City.
That's right. And people talk a lot, especially social scientists, talk a lot about this idea of the Irene effect. And it's sort of a fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on you sort of situation, where people thought, well, you know, we did evacuate for Irene. We went inland. You know, our homes, meanwhile, were not damaged by floodwaters. We got trapped by the floodwaters inland. We came home, found our homes looted. One of the most tragic stories I recount in the book is that of a family out on Staten Island who, for that reason, decided to stay when Sandy hit to protect their home, because they had been looted and had their home severely damaged by not the hurricane, but by robbers. And they tragically were swept away. The father and the daughter died, and the mother, you know, is still kind of trying to put the pieces together for her life.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking about Hurricane Sandy with Catherine Miles. Her book is Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. It's out from Dutton Press.
And I want to go back to what you were saying before about the National Hurricane Center passing this on. What exactly was it about this storm that made it so complicated that the National Hurricane Center felt like it was no longer responsible for getting the message out?
And we should say that the meteorologists at the National Hurricane Center felt very responsible in terms of getting the message out. But what we have here is a lot of political bureaucracy that can get in the way of good science. And so the way that the National Hurricane Center was defined by NOAA and by ultimately the Department of Commerce was that the National Hurricane Center forecasts tropical storms and only tropical storms. Sandy, very early in its genesis, began to take on characteristics of a hybrid storm. It merged with a nor'easter and became this sort of classic perfect storm. And when that happened, it was beyond the purview, beyond the sort of narrowly defined mission of the National Hurricane Center. And it created really a disaster of communication for everyone, so much so that in the months after the storm, the entire meteorological community got together and basically said, we cannot let this happen again. And so now the mission of the National Hurricane Center has been rewritten to allow them to continue issuing these advisories, even if a storm does transition. So that's a really good step forward. But it's not enough. And what we have is a just chronically underfunded weather program. We have one surge expert in the entire country who has to, you know, issue these surge forecasts for everyone from Miami to Maine. And that's a Herculean task that would take, you know, 10 people to do really well. And we have this one guy who works tirelessly trying to do it. And that's got to change. We've got to start investing so that we can get the word out, so people can make responsible choices, so we don't see the unnecessary death tolls like we saw in New York and New Jersey.
And is it true, as I think I've heard, that some of the most important weather forecasting machinery or technology that exists has been actually shut down in the United States. We were depending on the Europeans for the early forecasts of Hurricane Sandy.
Well, the National Hurricane Center uses about 40 models to do its hurricane prediction. And it's true that, one of them is the European model, and that's one that tends to perform really well. They also use their own models. But what you say about the larger weather infrastructure is entirely true. Because it has been so chronically underfunded for so long, they're really having to piece together with either outmoded equipment. One of the most important devices they use is what's called a scatterometer. It gauges wind speed and wind direction in the atmosphere. Theirs broke years ago, so we rely on other countries for that information. We're relying on the European Union for at least one of our satellite data feeds that we get every day. We are very close to being in a weather satellite gap where America has no functioning weather satellites, and that could continue for over 2 years, in which case we would need to look to Europe or even possibly China for that weather data information. And all of this really came to the forefront because of Sandy. I don't think we really knew just how bad a crisis it was until that storm hit. And so what we have is this real need to invest in infrastructure that's about personal security and also about national security. And I think we need to take that seriously.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Catherine Miles about her terrific book, Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. Now, Superstorm, as you said before, this system collided with a nor'easter. This was an extremely unusual weather pattern. Explain what happened and why do they think it might have happened the way it did?
And what was really interesting about this is the fact that hurricanes and nor'easters are very different types of storms. A hurricane derives its energy from warm ocean water. It sort of sucks up that moisture, and it works almost like a fuel in an engine, really. Nor'easters derive their energy from temperature differentials high up in the atmosphere. So usually when these two types of storms meet, they kind of become a soupy mess, and they cancel each other out. But in the case of Sandy, what happened was they took on sort of the worst characteristics of either storm, and it did become this sort of, you know, Frankenstorm or superstorm. You know, these used to be called the storms of the century because they were so unusual that we thought it could never really happen to us. But what meteorologists are telling us is that climate change, sea level rise, the temperature of the seas also rising, is creating a whole new paradigm for weather and how it works. And we're seeing this everywhere. We're seeing this in storms like Sandy that can get further north than they could ever get before, that are bigger than they ever were before. We saw it in that apocalyptic snowfall late last year in upstate New York. We saw it with the torrential downpours in California and Oregon. Everything we know about weather is changing, and we have to create a system that that accommodates these changes to make sure that we're ready for the weather of the 21st century.
Yeah, and that's a point that it seemed you didn't really go into very much in the book, and I wonder why. Of course, it's impossible to tie any one storm to climate change, but as you pointed out, the likelihood of these events is going up, and, you know, the national, you know, NOAA, has linked increasing numbers of hurricanes and possibly increasing intensity to sea level rise, certainly increasing damage. So I wonder if you could kind of unpack the link and the limits of it and how maybe you've evolved in some of your thinking about that over the course of writing this book.
What really surprised me in my research for this book, and also the reception of the book now that it's out, is just how controversial a subject climate change is among meteorologists. And I've been really surprised by the number of climate change deniers and climate change skeptics who work within the meteorological community that I've come across, you know, through the course of this book. What we do know for certain is two things. As I said earlier, you know, hurricanes derive their energy from warmth. And so the warmer the seas are, the more powerful, the more fuel the storms are going to have, the further north they're going to get. We also know that sea levels are hugely related to surge and the severity of surge. So obviously, the higher the sea level, the higher the surge level. And so, you know, the same storm hitting New York in 1900 is going to have less of an impact than the same storm hitting in 2015 because of these sea level rises. But beyond that, the meteorological community is very reluctant to take a strong stance about the specific ways in which climate change will affect the weather. And I think that's really curious. I think it's something that we're going to really need to focus more attention on and have at least some good predictions going forward so that we can make the accommodations that we need to anticipate those storms.
So do you think it's because weather forecasters are really dealing, climate change and weather are two different things, as the climatologists keep on telling us. Do you think it's an issue of focus that's really a problem?
I think that may be it. And when we look at how forecasting works, what we're dealing with is past precedent that weighs heavily in a forecast or a model. We're looking at things like, well, what is the likelihood that something is going to happen? So it's really a numbers game. It's a probability game coupled with new technology and things like satellite images. But this idea of this sort of long trajectory and how years or decades could affect the weather, like you say, that is a sort of climatological question, and it's not necessarily within the purview of, you know, the weatherman that we see on the nightly news. So as a community, they haven't really reached a very cohesive voice. I think things like Sandy, I think things like, the Senate finally voting to acknowledge that climate change is real, I think this is going to sort of compel meteorologists to start taking a stronger stance on that, to do more research, to look into the effects. But right now, they're so strapped for funds that we still have so many questions about how hurricanes work, that how hurricanes are affected as climate change is that much more of a complicated question that we just don't have the information to answer.
We're talking with Catherine Miles. Her book is Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy.
And as you so amply demonstrate in your book, this really comes down to impact. You know, whatever the cause is, the impact of Sandy was huge. Just lay out for us in a little snapshot, what was the impact of Superstorm Sandy?
And, you know, what's remarkable is that here we are over 2 years, almost 2.5 years after the storm, and we still are not entirely sure just how big the impact was, because more things keep coming out every single day. It was just very recently that Amtrak finally said, look, you know, it's going to take us another 2 years to fix our tracks and tunnels in New York. We're finding new reports about medical impacts, that the number of cardiac events increased dramatically after the storm, that the number of diabetes complications increased dramatically. We have the court systems that are completely bound up right now with suits being brought about by people who have not yet seen any insurance payment, because the insurance companies are claiming that because the storm wasn't a proper hurricane, they don't need to pay. So we don't even really know yet the total impact, but what we do know is millions and millions of dollars. We know that close to 200 people lost their lives. We know that New York and New Jersey are still very much in the process of rebuilding, and we can't even really account for the economic loss to places like that as well. So currently, the storm absolutely in the top five for most costly, even when you allow for inflation. But in terms of total cost, I think it's going to be another few years before we really know.
Wow. We're talking with Catherine Miles about her terrific book, Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. And you also bring this story down to the individual lives, especially the story of what happened to one of the tall ships, those, 19th century clipper ship models, the Bounty, which was in the film commissioned by MGM and for the 1962 film Mutiny on the Bounty, had on it one of the people that lost their lives was Claudine Christian, who actually claimed to be a descendant of Fletcher Christian in the story of the Bounty. Tell us what happened there. That just was heartrending to read.
I really wanted this book to be a very human story. I wanted to tell the narratives and the stories of the people who were impacted by the storm. And the bounty, as you said, was a really big one. And it was how I first got into this story. When the bounty left Connecticut, in New London, Connecticut, about 5 days before the storm made landfall, and the captain knew there was weather out there, knew it was a hurricane, but he really felt like he knew hurricanes well enough to guess what the storm was going to do. He felt really confident that the storm was going to take that sort of classic arc out to sea, which is what we see over and over again with these late season storms. And so he thought he would have plenty of room to get around it. And of course, he was tragically misinformed by this. The storm actually ended up in right where the bounty was. It was sort of a collision, if you will. And so much about this storm defied the rules of hurricanes. So hurricanes have a strong side and a weak side. He made his way to what should have been the weak side of the storm, but that had become inverted, so he inadvertently put the ship in the sort of worst conditions out there. The ship began to take on water. He became very badly injured by some accounts, broke his back. So there's some question about the degree to which he was able to make good decisions, given how much pain he was in. He delayed calling the Coast Guard because he really felt like the ship could make it. In the end, the first mate did call the Coast Guard. Conditions were so dangerous outside that the Coast Guard commander told his rescuers that they couldn't go. They defied him. They went out because they felt like it was so important to try to help. And what came from that was what is one of the costliest, one of the most dangerous Coast Guard rescues in history. Miraculously, they were able to save most of the crew members in a very harrowing rescue. But as you mentioned, Claudine Christian, a new deckhand, a fantastic, really interesting woman, you know, who grew up as a gymnast and a beauty queen and a sorority girl and a cheerleader, and like so many people, wanted to find herself on a tall ship. She and the captain of the ship both lost their lives. And, you know, when I started my research, this seemed like such an extreme story for Sandy. But what I learned really quickly is that it isn't. And, in fact, it's really emblematic of the decision so many people were making to weather out the storm or to go into the storm, because nobody believed that it could actually be that bad.
And also, the weather's getting more unpredictable, as you say. I mean, it might be a case that global warming had an impact on just the way this storm developed, the chaos of the storm.
And we're seeing weather that we wouldn't expect all over the place. This year we had typhoons well beyond typhoon season. We saw them in places we've never really seen them in modern history, like Hawaii, tornadoes in Washington State. So yeah, you know, new weather. And new weather comes with new risks, bigger risks. And we all have to find a way to acknowledge those risks. One of my favorite quotes from the book is from the commander of the Coast Guard down in North Carolina. And he said, you know, Mother Nature plays to win, and she'll beat you every time. And we've lost sight of that truth. But I think it's time that we really sort of re-embrace it.
That we're not the masters of the universe, we think.
We are not. We are absolutely not. The universe is absolutely the master of us.
Well, this is an amazing book. It's a real gripping tale. Superstorm, 9 days inside Hurricane Sandy. Catherine Miles, thanks so much for talking to us about this book. It is a warning, I would say, that everybody needs to read to open their eyes.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Catherine Miles, in addition to Superstorm, she's the author of two other books, All Standing and Adventures with Ari. Her work has appeared in dozens of publications, including Best American Essays, Outside, and The New York Times. Catherine Miles lives in Maine. Next up, what happens to beaches when homeowners try to protect their beach from property from sea level rise? It ain't pretty. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The battle over the coast is heating up. on Eastern Long Island, where I live, every week the local papers are filled with news about lawsuits that pitch homeowners against town trustees. The issue is this: the wealthy like to build their mega mansions on the beach. As the changing climate threatens to wash away their property with rising seas and surging storms, they build seawalls and groins to try and hold back the ocean. But those hardened structures increase the velocity of the waves, scouring adjacent beaches of their sand and worsening the erosion of the coast. Meanwhile, town trustees are charged with protecting public beaches. They're trying to hold back the tide of money and power that is riding roughshod over the coastal commons. One community facing the conflict between coastal resilience and protecting private property is Southhold on the North Fork of Eastern Long Island. I spoke with marine scientist Doug Hardy. He was commissioned by Southhold's Conservation Advisory Council to write a report for the town about the issue. It's titled The Starvation of Southhold's Beaches. I originally produced the interview for a local radio show on sustainability I helped produce for community radio station WPKN, along with co-producer Tony Ernst. I've borrowed the interview with Doug Hardy for Writer's Voice.
You wrote this report for the Conservation Advisory Council of Southhold, New York. First of all, just tell us, what is the Conservation Advisory Council?
Well, it's a council that was created by the town board to advise the town trustees. And so we only offer advice to the town trustees, and they can take it or leave it.
And why were you chosen to write this report?
Well, I've had a career in marine science, and it was just a natural fit. I was a research oceanographer for 7 years at the Marine Science Center at Stony Brook. And then for the next 20-odd years, I was a professor running a program called SEAMESTER at Southampton College.
SEAMESTER?
SEA, yes, that's correct.
I have to compliment you, by the way. I think you're a terrific writer.
Oh, thank you.
So you and the Conservation Advisory Council are concerned that hardened structures being built by property owners who live on the waterfront are damaging the beaches. Tell us why you're concerned.
First, I wouldn't put it that there are villains here. It's just the way the process has, the town trustees has been established for over 120, I think, in 1894, and so it's over 100-something-odd years. And it's just a process that has gradually evolved, and now that the sea level rise has accelerated in the mid-1990s, it's become a real problem.
Well, tell us, what do you mean by hardened structures, and what are your concerns about them? So for those of us who, you know, don't even know what a hardened structure is, tell us what's going on.
Well, a hardened structure is a bulkhead, a seawall, these are groins, anything that is unnatural and put by man along the seashore to prevent erosion.
Are these happening more and more?
Well, yes, it's being bitten now because the sea level rose slowly for the first 100 years, and the sea level was regarded as being fairly stable. But around 1995, something happened. And now the sea level is rising 3 or 4 times the historical rate.
Since 1995?
Yeah, that's about roughly in the mid-90s.
And how much has it risen since then?
Well, since 1995, this is a matter of a few inches. But from 1850, when the industrial age began to peak, to the mid-90s, or approximately a foot. And the expectation by the best peer-reviewed scientist is that in the next 85 years, it will rise 3 feet or 3.5 feet.
Isn't that lowballing it a bit? I mean, I've heard that it could rise as much as 3 meters.
generally, scientists tend to be conservative. The potential is 3 meters is probably more probable beyond 2100. The sea level will continue to rise. Well, let's go back 135,000 years ago at the beginning of the last interglacial period. The sea level was 20 to 30 feet higher than what it is today. And these cycles of glaciation and interglaciation has gone has been repeated 8-9 times in probably the last 800,000 years. And so this cycle of sea level rise and then periods, extended periods of glaciation is not unnatural. But the problem today is that the release of greenhouse gases, it may be a runaway, and that the and that we may not be able to stop the warming. That's the fear of many scientists.
And in fact, I mean, the sea level has been even higher, a couple hundred feet higher, when you didn't have so much ice at the poles. Isn't there also some concern of some, you know?
Well, the worst case scenario, I think approximately the figures are, if all of Greenland and Antarctica melted, the sea level could rise over 160 feet.
Mm-hmm.
That would cause Long Island to essentially disappear.
Right.
But we're talking now of several hundred years from now.
Mm-hmm. Now, so explain the process. Explain why these hardened structures that people are putting up to protect their homes, and we have to say this is not on the hundreds of years scale, this is on within decades, years long, where people are feeling that their houses are being undermined. I mean, we've seen the pictures as well when storms happen, there's storm surge. So explain the process as to why it is so damaging to beaches. I mean, you call this report the starvation of Southold's beaches. Why the starvation with these structures?
Well, it's a dynamic process, and to maintain the beach, you need a continual ribbon of sand being deposited. And if you prevent the sand from being mined in certain areas, the beaches down current will not be re-nourished, so they will gradually thin and disappear.
And have you been seeing this happen already?
Yes. The report that we submitted to the town board shows photographs of just a short section of the North Shore of Southold Town, and you could see evidence of severe erosion.
In fact, you say that those who are putting up bulkheads are putting into danger the very homes of their neighbors.
It accelerates the erosion of adjacent neighbors who fail for one reason or another. It may be financial, it may be disinterest, but they accelerate the erosion of their nearby neighbors while their properties are being temporarily protected.
Temporarily, explain. Why is it only temporary?
Because as the sea level rises, that means that heavy waves, that large waves, these are episodic events during storm events. In the particular instance of the North Shore of Long Island, northeast storms and northwest winds. So episodes of these, you get incidents of severe erosion.
The pictures show that not only are beaches being eroded, I mean, the bluffs are being eroded on the neighbors' properties, but the pictures and your text shows that they're also the foundations of the homes that have put up these bulkheads are also being eroded.
The ocean doesn't withhold any fury. These are just man-made structures, and when you get storm surges and on top of those heavy waves, you have tons of water pouring on these structures, and very few of them can withstand it.
And this is not just an issue of private property, is it? I mean, it seems that there is a collision between private property interests and public property rights. Could you explain that?
Yes. When this country was founded, it adopted the English common law, and where the shoreline was held in trust for the public good. And this has been ignored, well, not just in South Old Town, but nationwide, because the sea level has been rising up to the mid-90s fairly slowly. And so you get away with building structures that were just at the edge of the mean high water. But now the mean high water is underwater. And so there's a real legal question. Does the property rights of the landowner extend underwater? And there's been a series of Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, and New York State Supreme Court decisions that hold that the state, federal or state, cannot abdicate its title to land that's under the ebb and flow of the tide.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. We're airing an interview I did with marine scientist Doug Hardy about the report he wrote for the town of Southold, New York. It's about how hard structures homeowners build to protect beachfront property from the ocean are damaging the beaches.
In other words, you're saying that somebody could have bought a property that, you know, let's say it's 3 acres at shoreline property. An acre of that is on the beach, and that beach is being eroded, and that as sea level rises, it creeps closer inland, and that according to this public doctrine of rights, that as that land is eroded, the homeowner owns less and less of the original property because now that's coming underwater. Is that correct?
That's what the law appears to say. There's a good point to this.
Mm-hmm.
If for some reason the shoreline extends outward or accretes and extends outward into the sea, the landowner can claim that, and so he gains property. Now, the law should have a certain degree of symmetry.
So who owns the beach?
Well, the law states that for Long Island Sound, the state owns all land below mean high water. The riparian owner or waterfront property owner owns that property above mean high water.
So is this being challenged, or let's just say, how does this legal issue come into play in this clash of interest between private homeowners who want to fortify their section of the beach against erosion and the public's right to the beach? How do these two things clash under this law?
This is a complicated issue, but one problem is a poor land acquisition decision. In other words, the person who buys a property should have his eyes opened that these natural events are occurring on the property. So poor real estate decisions are one factor. Another factor is that local as well as state and federal governments are ignoring the public trust doctrine. And so if it came to court, probably the state, by the law, has the ability to revoke certain property rights that are under the ebb and flow of the tides.
And what is this public trust doctrine? What is its state?
Well, it's been supported by a number of decisions by the U.S. and the New York State Supreme Court.
But what is it? I mean, the public trust doctrine isn't just about beaches.
No, it is part of the common law, but the part that I have some knowledge about, I am not a lawyer, however, is concerned with the waterfront.
Could you just explain the concept of public trust?
Well, the public trust doctrine claims that the shoreline below mean high water, the land is owned by the state. In the case of the Peconic Bays and Long Island Sound, in the case of the town creeks and so forth, the town holds title. And they are holding title in trust for the public good. That means that there's a hierarchy here. The public good is the top dog, so to speak. There are certain areas, though, that are gray areas, such as marinas, where while they may be privately owned, and they do provide a public service and have so far been interpreted for the public good. And so, therefore, the private property owner cannot impede in any way the navigation or the use of the shoreline below mean high water. And this is being violated quite badly.
Violated?
Yes, the town is illegally allowing, because as the sea level is creeping up, I don't know if you are a walker of the shoreline, but in many places you can't go very far until you encounter a bulkhead, a groin, or some other obstruction to your passage.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I live near Maidstone Beach in Springs, and it's impossible to go, except at very low tide, to walk along the beach beyond a certain point. But what I want to ask you then is, how does this public trust doctrine, I mean, it sounds like it's just applying to the property that's in front of these homes that are on the waterfront. But we started out this conversation talking about how these hardened structures are actually eroding public beaches downstream, you know, if you can use that term, with the ocean. Who is protecting the public beaches and making sure that they remain in existence so that the public can enjoy them?
In South Old Town, it's the town trustees. And similar in Southampton and East Hampton, they have trustees. And they are responsible for regulating the shoreline for the public good. And it's not being done.
And it's not being done because of what we're talking about here today?
Probably the biggest fear of a town is being sued. And since for the last 100 years, precedences have been set, it would be a legal question. And if you have many lawsuits, it's a great expense for the town. And so they've turned their eyes away from the problem.
So you're saying they're allowing these structures because they don't want to be sued, and that's a rubber.
I think that's one problem, yes.
Well, talking about expense to the taxpayers, what about the expense of replenishing beaches? Because as I understand, that's something that the towns are spending quite a bit of money on. Is that related to this problem as well?
They have to re-nourish the beaches because of the hardening of the shoreline. And so, again, these poor real estate decisions are being partly funded by the general taxpayer, which isn't fair.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. We're airing an interview I did with marine scientist Doug Hardy about the report he wrote for the town of Southold, New York. It's about how hard structures homeowners build to protect beachfront property from the ocean are damaging the beaches.
So now you have some recommendations that are in this report, the starvation of Southold's beaches. What are your recommendations?
The recommendation I particularly suited to what we were looking at was unvegetated bluffs, which for the North Shore of Southold Town are a main source of sediment to continually nourish the beach. And if these unvegetated bluffs are hardened, there will be no sand. And then gradually, over time, the beaches will then disappear. This allows then storm waves to attack the shoreline above many of these bulkheads and so forth, which is already happening. And so what we recommended was, is one, there should be an education to a potential investor in shoreline property, is they should consider that shoreline erosion is a natural event. And what they could do is the town could require a deepening of the property and also to design homes that as the bluff line retreats landward, the architectural design of the property could be designed so it could be easily moved backwards. In other words, moved away from the bluff. And so there should be sufficient land for the property. And also to minimize any hardening of the bluff.
You say in this report that unvegetated bluffs should be declared sensitive areas.
Right. And it should recognize their value in nourishing the beaches from Matatuck to Orient.
Would this have an implication on property prices, do you think?
Oh, it certainly will be. That's why it's going to be a very contentious issue.
In other words, a sensitive area is going to mean that the property will be worth less.
So this will be a very political issue. There's no doubt about it. But there's one thing that you can be sure of, is that the sea level is going to raise higher and higher, and it has no conscience whatsoever. And it's an overwhelming force. And any military strategist will tell you that when you encounter an overwhelming force, you retreat.
Well, there are those who say that, you know, what government should actually do is buy up these properties, compensate landowners, and make sure that the shoreline is in fact uninhabited so that it can be a buffer for other residential areas. What do you think of that?
Well, that would certainly be a solution, but I doubt if Southold Town, at any event, has the funds to do that.
Is this something that should be done on the state and federal level to enable towns to do
this?
Well,
it would have to be.
Do you think that that is going to be inevitable if we don't do
the kind of... Well, it's already being done, particularly on the South Shore, after Storm Sandy, that's already happening.
Do you think it's going to take a storm, or are these recommendations that you make to Southold, could they be seen as interim or, you know, moderate measures that could serve to avoid the eventual retreat from the coast?
Well, I think possibly now the climate isn't good for it because the effects are here, but they are not dramatically obvious. And so it probably will take several great Northeasters to convince people that something should be done. Whether the time is right now, I have no idea.
So the Conservation Advisory Council was charged by the Southold Town to come up with this report that you wrote. What do you think is going to be, or have you already seen, you know, the reception for this report?
Well, so far, it's been early. We only did it, I guess, last week. But it's easy politically to kick the ball down the field. And so what it may end up in is another study. And that's a nice way to postpone a real decision.
Do you think the townspeople should actually organize politically? Because after all, the taxpayers are the ones who are bearing the brunt of decisions that are being made by private landowners. They're basically subsidizing these landowners' private property and property values.
That's quite correct. But it's hard to motivate people who live inland or not exactly on the shore, is they've got other problems, and it's hard to consolidate them. You know, they have kids to raise and mortgages to do, and they're not as focused. A property owner on the coastline is very focused. Generally, they have a very established network of communication. They're quite articulate, and they're fairly wealthy. You've got to think that in Southold Town, there may be a few individuals that have waterfront property whose GDP, gross domestic product, exceeds that of Southold Town itself, and so that they could put in litigation for years to defend their property desires or wishes.
Well, Doug Hardy, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here. The report is The Starvation of Southold's Beaches. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
That interview was originally produced for the monthly radio show Sustainable East End on WPKN 89.5 FM out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. You can find a link to Doug Hardy's report by going to writersvoice.net. We have a little time left for a poem about how sea level rise is threatening coastal nations around the world. Jetnal Kitchener is a poet from one of those nations, the Marshall Islands. She was one of 38 civil society representatives chosen to speak at the September 2014 UN Climate Summit. Here she is reciting her poem, Dear Matafeli Painem.
Dear Matafeli Painem, you are a seven-month-old sunrise of gummy smiles. You are bald as an egg and bald as the Buddha. Your thighs that are thunder, shrieks that are lightning, so excited for bananas, hugs, and our morning walks along the lagoon. Dear Matafeli Painem, I want to tell you about that lagoon, that lucid, sleepy lagoon lounging against the sunrise. Men say that one day, that lagoon will devour you. They say it will gnaw at the shoreline, chew at the roots of your breadfruit trees, gulp down rows of your seawalls, and crunch through your island's shattered bones. They say you, your daughter, and your granddaughter too, will wander rootless, with only a passport to call home. Dear Matafeli Painem, don't cry. Mommy promises you, no one will come and devour you. No greedy whale of a company sharking through political seas, no backwater bullying of businesses with broken morals, no blindfolded bureaucracies gonna push this mother ocean over the edge. No one's drowning, baby. No one's moving. No one's losing their homeland. No one's gonna become a climate change refugee. Or should I say, no one else. To the Carteret Islanders of Papua New Guinea and to the Taro Islanders of Fiji, I take this moment to apologize to you. We are drawing the line here. Because baby, we are going to fight. Your mommy, daddy, boo-boo, dimma, your country, and your president too, we will all fight. And even though there are those hidden behind platinum titles who like to pretend that we don't exist, that the Marshall Islands, Tuvalu, Kiribati, Maldives, and Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, and floods of Pakistan, Algeria, and Colombia, and hurricanes, tidal waves, and earthquakes didn't exist, still, there are those who see us. Hands reaching out, fists raising up, banners unfurling, megaphones booming, and we are canoes blocking coal ships. We are the radiance of solar villages. We are the rich, clean soil of the farmer's past. We are petitions blooming from teenage fingertips. We are families biking, recycling, reusing, engineers dreaming, designing, building, artists painting, dancing, writing. We are spreading the word. And there are thousands out on the street, marching with signs, hand in hand, chanting for change now. They're marching for you, baby. They're marching for us. Because we deserve to do more than just survive. We deserve to thrive. Dear Matafeli Painem, you are eyes heavy with drowsy weight. So just close those eyes, baby, and sleep in peace. Because we won't let you down. You'll see.
Jetnal Kitchener reciting her poem, Dear Matafeli Painem, at the UN Climate Summit in September 2014. Find a link to the video at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.